Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, July 9th, 2009. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. This week, we continue our coverage of the National Homebrewers Conference in Oakland, California, with the mead panel discussion. Stellar mead makers share some tips and show their different approaches to making great meads. If you're new to home brewing and would like to get into the hobby for the first time, check out our website, basicbrewing.com, where you can find archives of our audio and video podcasts and our DVDs to walk you through basic and more advanced brewing techniques. And you can follow me on Twitter. My username is Basic Brewing, all one word. Also, you can find me on Facebook at facebook.com/basicbrewing.james. We also have a Basic Brewing Radio and Basic Brewing Video page on Facebook. And if you become a fan of the show there, I'll be sending out little notices when I post an audio or video episode. Thanks again to everybody clicking on the Amazon.com associate link on our basicbrewing.com site. Whenever you think of Amazon, think of us and click on our associate link first. It won't cost you any extra, and you'll be helping us to bring you the show. We appreciate your support, and there's a chance I may read your item at the end of the show, as I do every week, randomly selected. We also have associate links for Brew Your Own magazine and the American Homebrewers Association on our site, too. Our first Basic Brewing video episode from Oakland is out there now. Steve and I prowl around Pro Night and talk to both home and professional brewers. We had a lot of fun there, of course. And this is the first episode of Basic Brewing Video with our fancy new open, designed by our buddy Chris Hart, who also designed our DVD packaging and the little icons that you see, the little radio and the little TV that you see on iTunes when you click on our show. Very talented guy, who is now free of the corporate world, by the way, and out on his own. So if you need some well-done graphic design from an experienced designer, let me know. This is another show that is going to break my rule of not going over an hour, so I want to get right to it. A while back, I was contacted by Jamil Zainashev, who was one of the conference organizers out in Oakland, and Jamil asked me if I would be interested in moderating a couple of panels, and I said, sure. And then I began worrying, not having done anything like that before. But it turns out that when you have a solid group of experts like these guys on a panel, it almost runs itself. So there was actually nothing to worry about. The only thing that didn't go as I planned was that I was gonna run around with a microphone, Phil Donahue style, and catch the questions from the audience so that you guys would be sure to hear it. But audience members were way too quick for me, so I abandoned that pretty much immediately. But I hope that you can tell what the questions were by how the panel members answered them. The thing that I thought was most fun to listen to was the different approaches that each of these guys take. There's an old saying that if you ask 10 different brewers how to brew, you'll get 12 different answers back, and I think that same rule applies here. So enough of me talking. Let's go to Oakland, California to meet the mead panel. My name is James Spencer. I'm host of Basic Brewing Radio and Basic Brewing Video. There's Steve Wilkes, who's the other half of the equation. And we are recording this for Basic Brewing Radio, so you can listen later on if you miss a question. Joining us on the panel is Byron Birch, who's been Homebrewer of the Year once, Mead Maker of the Year three times, author of Brewing Quality Beers and founder of The Beverage People in Santa Rosa, California. This next gentleman you may recognize, he's pretty much the reason you're here. Not the reason you're here on the earth, but the reason you're here in this building. He may be known as the beer god, but maybe not. Charlie Papazian is the founder of the AHA. He's president of the Brewers Association, author of several books, including Microbrewed Adventures, The Homebrewer's Companion, and the book that taught me how to brew, The Complete Joy of Homebrewing. Kurt Stock has been homebrewing since 1996, making mead since 2003, has won beer and mead best of shows, was the 2005 AHA Mead Maker of the Year, and is co-founder of the St. Paul Homebrewers Club, the 2007 and 2008 AHA Club of the Year. And Harold Gulbranson has been brewing for more than 15 years, became interested in mead at a quaff meeting in San Diego in 1998. So, what I'm hoping to do today is to kind of make this as interactive as possible. We'll ask some basic questions to begin with, but if you have a question, raise your hand and I'll run out there Phil Donahue style and hand you the mic and we can start a discussion and tap some of the excellent knowledge that's sitting up here at the table. I ask my listeners and Facebook people and Twitter followers to send in some questions, so we'll start with a couple of those. Les from Las Vegas, Nevada, says, for the mead panel, what is the one single most important recommendation that you would make for the home brewer who's never done a mead before but wants to do their first? It's one of those trick questions. Who wants to start?
I'll start it. Can you hear me?
Yeah, you might want to sneak up to the mic.
I started making meads, I believe it was in the late 80s, and was obviously successful right away. The third mead I ever made was the first one that won Mead Maker of the Year. And the way that I did that, probably most importantly, was that I had been making wine for a good number of years. There is a strong carryover from the winemaking tradition that really helps somebody get into the mead making. Now, there's a lot of the same principles that carry over. You're dealing with total acidity as well as pH. You're dealing with sugar levels in a lot of the standard meads that are more akin to winemaking. And you're often employing fruit, and so techniques of fruit handling, things like pectic enzymes and so on, are going to be relevant that are not necessarily going to mean anything to a lot of home brewers who are not doing fruit beers and things like that. So I would say reading some books on winemaking and getting immersed in that tradition can be very, very helpful as general background that home brewers may not have in approaching mead making.
Yeah, well, I'm going to take a completely different approach. First of all, I have to clarify what kind of mead maker I am. I am not a technical mead maker. I haven't read a whole lot of books, or the ones that I did were early on just to get me started. I'm more of an experiential mead maker. I learn by doing and listening and smelling and tasting and making mistakes and just going with the flow. You know, I'm almost the opposite of what my approach is, and I'm not saying anything about which is better. They're all great approaches, I think, is that what's meant to me is meant to be. You know, I put fruit in, I put herbs in, I use honey. Rarely do I look at pH. You know, if I'm shooting for gravity and it comes up short or it comes up high, it's what it's meant to be. And those are the things. That's my approach in general to mead, and I share usually my information is just sharing experiences. And one of to answer that question about what is one of the most important things to consider is that if you're going to get into mead making, in general, most commercial meads that I have tasted are not indicative of the really great quality and potential that mead can be. All of the best meads I have ever had have been by mead makers, bar none. And I think that has a large, and we can talk about this later, has a large amount to do with oxidation and bottling capabilities and using preservatives such as SO2, which can be overdone, and you just lack the control of the mead after you package it as a commercial mead maker. Now, not to say that there's some good ones, probably some good ones out there, but by far the best world-class meads are the small batches that every one of you either are making or are going to make after this presentation.
I guess the single most thing, and I'm not shy to pimp Ken's book, so The Complete Mead Maker by Ken Schramm is a really good resource to start with. It's the only brew book I've ever read, sorry. But But it's a really good resource, even though the techniques in there aren't exactly what even Ken uses or any of the mead makers are really doing anymore. But it's a really good resource for honey characterization and how to deal with fruit and how much fruit to use, that kind of thing, what kind of combinations. And the probably the biggest thing, other thing, other than just reading and getting information like Byron and Charlie have said, is your ingredient, which mainly is honey, unless you're using fruit too. But find a good quality honey, and just because it tastes good doesn't mean it'll make good mead. So, I mean, there's trial and error, but just make sure your ingredients are the best ones you can find. So,
I'd say in my experience, obviously quality honey from a local provider is probably the most important thing to get. And I think managing your yeast and the nutrients for your yeast to get a nice, healthy fermentation, because meads, you know, there isn't really very much nutrient value for the yeast in honey. So you really need to just do a little work on reading and understanding how to manage nutrients and how to get your mead to go through a nice, healthy fermentation.
Speaking of the, well, first of all, how many are mead makers here today?
Well, everyone.
So how many have been making meads for more than a year? More than 5 years? More than 10 years? 15? 20? 25? Wow, so we've got some experienced mead makers in here.
I guess we're done then.
Yeah, we're done. Y'all come up here. And no, seriously, if you have something to add to the discussion from your experience, if you are an experienced mead maker, raise your hand and we'll... Yeah, let's talk about it. Let's talk about nutrients
well,
in specific.
Actually, I brought a mead, which is kind of an experiment. It's in the red. It's on the right tap handle of the red jockey box. And I was always trained and told that meads require an incredible amount of patience, which I don't have a lot of, and that, you know, you need to set them. And I've told many, many fellow brewers, just, you know, put your mead in the closet for a year and don't even think about it, and then come back and maybe taste it and blend it and spice it a year or a year and a half later. Kurt and I exchanged a few emails in thinking about this panel, and I sort of challenged myself to see if I could get a mead to mature quickly and make it certainly not a world-class mead, but at least a mead that you could drink. Number one, I lowered the gravity. There's a home brewer in our audience here as a president of our club who's developed some diabetic problems and obviously had to go to lower. And Chris started bringing these wonderful, really low-gravity meads that were really fun and refreshing and carbonated. So I basically brewed a no-boil mead with an original gravity of 1073 on May 1st. So this was, and each day I added about 2 grams of, half a teaspoon of diammonium phosphate, and then a half a teaspoon of Fermade K on brew day, and then every day agitated it with one of those little whirly gigs that you hook up to your drill, which I learned about last year at the conference from Chris England. And then every other day added another half a teaspoon of diammonium, quarter of a teaspoon of diammonium phosphate and 1/8 of a teaspoon of Fermade K. And it was basically done. It went from down to 0.990 in about a week. And so it fermented cleanly, quickly. And then I also added some cinnamon and some cardamom to it because, I don't know, I have a cardamom and cinnamon problem. And in Southern California, we don't get the opportunity to get quite the volume of fruit that some of our brothers and sisters can get in the Midwest where they have orchards in their backyard, you know. So I'm more of a metheglin kind of brewer. And then I racked it to secondary, and then I fined it with some sparkaloid at about a month, and so it's about 7 weeks old. And again, it's not wonderful, but it's got some characters. But the fermentation, the key to fermentation is agitation, oxygenation initially, and then keep the, you know, every day stir the meat up and refeed the yeast so that it can ferment properly. Does that answer your question about, So, and it's, and I'll ditto with what Kurt said, Ken Schramm's book. And there's also a Zymergy article about 2005, I think, January, that has a really great summary of this sequential feeding of your yeast in mead making.
So what do you guys think about the mead, the young, actively fermented mead?
Well, one of the interesting things is she just came up and poured some for me, and I didn't realize it was the same mead that had been poured in the plastic glass, and they smell completely different. And we've been passing it on down the line and comparing smells. It's very different in the one glass than in the other glass. It's quite good and quite clean. And
When was this made?
May 1st
of 2009.
So, Charlie, I take it that doesn't follow your traditional fermentation regime.
No, you know me. Relax, don't worry, have a homebrew. But I'm aware that there are techniques out there. You know, you've probably read about Leon Havel, who in New Zealand, in my book, I mention him. He has a meadery just outside of Christchurch in New Zealand, and it was through him that I really tasted my first traditional meads. I won't go into the story, but I encountered him. I flew down and visited him. I didn't know of him the day before, 24 hours earlier, and I stayed a couple of days, and he told me tales of mead. And to this day, he still is making mead. And his whole shtick was, you know, as a commercial mead maker, you need to, you know, turn around your mead. And he is really into the traditional mead, no fruits and such. And his whole shtick was, and it was very, he still doesn't let on what he's doing, but I'm sure it's about feeding the yeast and their proper nutrients. And he basically has said up, you know, I don't know whether he gets Zymergy magazine, but at these days, but you know, for many years, he says there's nothing been published on what he has learned, and to be able to knock out a mead in a month that tastes every bit as good as you would expect after a year or so using let's just for the natural techniques without any feeding of the of mead. What I do personally, I'll put in a bit of a yeast extract in the beginning to give it a boost. And generally, you guys can relate your experience, but generally, if I, for example, my meads generally go down 100 points. If it's 1.140, it goes down to 40. And if it's 1.150, it goes down to 50. And generally, I have a little bit of fluctuation, but that's about a 14.5% natural fermentation with, you know, generally mixed yeast that I throw, hydrate and throw in there with, again, plenty of, as much aeration as I can do naturally. And, you know, you learn stuff every day, you know. Hell, I might go out and get an aerator.
And, Charlie, what's your fermentation schedule?
Oh, my fermentation schedule is, my wife bugs me and says, did you make mead this year again? Yeah. And it's usually, well, if you're not going to do it, I'm going to do it. So she's become a mead maker herself. It's, you know, I have a pretty good stash, and generally I'm usually not drinking anything that's less than 5 or 6 years old, and I have a stash that goes back. I have 20-year-old mead of my own stuff. So generally my fermentation schedule is to make at least 1 5-gallon batch a year, and always have enough on hand that I don't feel like I need to be stingy when I have friends around, then share it and take it to special occasions. And you know, I'm a special occasion mead drinker. I'm not an everyday mead drinker. And I have such a stash that I don't have that pressure to kind of turn things around in 2 months. So, and I think with certain, and I like to experiment with almost all my meads have a prickly pear base. And then if I do herb or fruits, I'll add those. And with certain fruits, particularly the ones that have any bit of tannin in it, you need to either feed it something or do something with it to reduce that tannin, or just let it sit.
So how long does it take for you to lose those 100 points?
Again, that depends on the honey. Depends on the honey and the fruit. I'll have similar batches of mead. One batch, I'll prepare it and split it between two fermenters. Let both of them go, and after a month, it may have dropped half. And to one, I'll add ginger, fresh, or some other fruit, and the one without the fruit or the ginger or the anything that I put in it is still slowly fermenting, while the other one has skyrocketed. It's plummeted almost within 3 or 4 weeks. So there are definitely nutrients and various things that you put in that really affect fermentation even after you have it going.
And Byron, what's your nutrition?
Well, I'm happy to second or third, I guess, the endorsement of Ken Schramm's book, especially since he gave our yeast nutrient from the beverage people a plug in the book. So since we got on that subject, we put out a special nutrient for meads. It's a rather complex formula. If you want it, it's on page 62 of Roger Morse's book, Making Mead. It was developed back when he was at Cornell, and it's our packaged mead that we sell is very, very close to that formulation, if not exactly. It's a formulation that, under ideal conditions, as he said in that older book, they had determined in their research that fermentation should last about 3 weeks for most meads. The ideal conditions were fermentation temperatures of 75 to 80 degrees and a pH of approximately 3.75. And I don't usually, I'm a little more relaxed about things than that. And I usually am happy if it's 4 to 5 weeks, because I don't have quite the temperature control, and I'm not so worried about pH exactly as that. But that's what I do. I do my meads in the summertime because that's optimum temperature conditions where I live. Let them set through the winter, and usually bottle about March is what works for me. Can I tell a Leon Havel story?
Sure.
Quickly. Charlie brought up Leon and said something about not knowing if he gets Symergy. Well, I can assure you that at one point he did, because the first year that I was Mead Maker of the Year, the recipe, of course, was published in Symergy. Well, it happened that that winter, a home brewer from this area named Vern Wolf, who some of you who've been around a while may remember, he happened to be traveling down in New Zealand and looked up the Havel Meadery on Charlie's recommendation. And Symergy had just arrived. And Leon was cussing me out one side and down the other. And how can any stupid person use any Irish moss, you know, in their mead? And he went on ranting and raving for apparently about 10 minutes. And Vern is going, wait a minute, I've tasted his mead. You know, there's no problem at all with this. It's good. Well, anyway, it turned out to be one of those things, to make a long story short, after they got discussing it a bit, it turns out that in New Zealand, Irish moss is a brand of a very popular mouthwash. And Leon had apparently fired off a letter to Symergy magazine. I don't know if Charlie remembers this, but he had to make a phone call to intercept this scathing letter denouncing me to the heavens. So at one point he did get Symergy.
Kurt, do you have any more thoughts on nutrition?
I guess I started doing staggered, we call them staggered nutrient additions, you know, similar to what Harold explained. And It just does a really good job, you know, whatever mixture you use, but you got to make sure you have some yeast hulls and some minerals and a little bit, you know, everything the yeast needs, plus a lot of nitrogen. But I think one big part of the whole staggered nutrient addition is every, you know, once or twice a day, however often you break up your additions, is you're also stirring out all the CO2 that's dissolved in there, which is fairly toxic to yeast. It's just they don't like that. They want oxygen. They don't need CO2, which kind of snuffs them out. And the healthy yeast fermentation, it produces, you know, more of just ethanol instead of some of the higher alcohols when it gets stressed. So
the important thing for people to realize, if they haven't done this before, Harold mentioned the little wick you put in your drill. Do not try this if you're doing it in a carboy. It's a bad plan.
Slowly.
It's amazing the foam you'll drive out of that yeast when you do that.
Well, one of the things that this is a pretty, everybody I assume has tasted this mead. It's a pretty remarkable mead for being made brewed at the beginning of May. Though I have to, one of the things about nutrients is that often if you're not experienced with using nutrients, it's very easy to overdo. And if you overdo certain kinds of nutrients, it leaves a vitamin character, or for lack of a better term, a yeasty vitamin B kind of character in mead. And, you know, I get that in some of the commercial meaderies that just tend to kind of overdo it a bit. I'm getting a little bit, you know, for me, I pick up a little bit of that nutrient character. And I mean, you're probably more experienced with this, is, you know, does the nutrient character go away with time? It may over a lengthy period. One of the things about my personal thinking is that quick meads are smooth, clean, ready to drink, enjoyable, but they can never achieve the complexity of a mead that's been sitting around and being taken care of for 1 year plus or 2 years. And the meads that I really enjoy are more often than not the ones that have had time to develop that mysterious complexity of character that, in my opinion, can only be achieved with age. And, of course, there's some negative oxidation that has a potential to happen. As a home mead maker, you can do things to minimize and control that process, but there's some good oxidation characters that I think are, it's that overall impression on the bottom of the score sheet that is the complexity of flavors that happen, that arise, that get interlocked with each other, and it's a mystery, and it's part of that enjoyment that it's hard to pick it apart and say I want to get there in a shorter time. I don't think it's for the sake of arguing, I don't think you can get there but with 2 or 3 months old meats.
Yeah, I mean I totally agree. This was totally an experiment to see if I could even do it. And this is also an original gravity of 1073. Meads that I cherish and cellar are all gravities of 1.1 something. Mm-hmm. That I don't touch for a year. But it was just kind of a fun experiment to see if I could do something quick that would be reasonably drinkable, and you could take it to someplace and not have it be overly heavily alcoholic, which is a lot of what, it's just that I don't hear a lot of people talking about low gravity meads very often. That was the point of the experiment.
In my experience, the nutrient character, I think the one that Charlie is referring to, although I don't know, we'd have to do a side-by-side tasting to be mm-hmm. sure. But I've always associated nutrient taste problems with diammonium phosphate. You can use too much DAP, and that can give you a flavor that you don't want.
Now, talking about aging for an extended period of time, I got a question from Brad in Appleton, Maine, who was aging. Oh, thank you very much. who was aging a mead for his daughter's 21st birthday. He made it when she was 11. And he aged it in a topped-off carboy. And his question is it better to age it in a bulk fashion, or is it better to bottle individually and age it that way? Or does it make a difference?
Well, you have in a topped-off carboy, you have less oxygen in the airspace for volume of liquid. So right then and there, if the oxygen is going to, if you've done things that would solicit that oxygen to kind of, whatever, I'm looking for the word of opposite of an enhance, the mead, you're better off using a carboy for that time. You know, you have that same amount of airspace in a 750 milliliter bottle. It's different.
I'd like to ask a question. I know I'm supposed to answer them, but I guess I'd like to ask Charlie. He's talked a lot about oxidation. I don't find that meads are necessarily are detracted by a little touch of oxidation. I think it actually kind of enhances the mead. I don't know.
Have you ever had commercial meads that have been on the shelf for a while?
No.
Yeah, you get that veg. It's not just sherification. It's the vegetal paper, raunchy, cabbagey. That's definitely the track. It's not good. It's not good. And you know, and mead that if you're siphoning and splashing your mead in the bottle when you're bottling, that's gonna your mead's not gonna get to 5 years old. That's for sure. 1 year old, you're not gonna like it.
What's your oldest?
What's the old? My oldest mead?
Yeah, your oldest one.
I might. I've opened up just recently a 25-year-old mead, and it's just great.
How do you manage to keep that?
I make it hard to get to.
you know,
every once every couple of years, I'm rearranging the. Oh, look what I have! I didn't know I had that.
You're not breaking your bottles at all before you bottle your mead.
I'm not what?
You're not breaking your bottles of CO2.
No, I just. I do wax all my meads, wax one way or another. And, you know, there was a little discussion on the forum or somewhere. Where was it that I? Oh, in Zymergy, maybe. It was Dear Professor. And there was one person said, you know, bullshit. You know, the oxidation's going to happen in the bottle whether you wax it or not. Of course, if the oxygen is in the bottle already, that's going to oxidize. But it's, you know, how many saw Ken's talk this, you know, just prior to this? He talked about ingress, air ingress through bottle caps. You know, their airs, you know, it keeps the CO2 in, but if there's, you know, the balance of oxygen is less in the bottle than it is outside, the oxygen seeps through underneath, through the cap lining into the bottle. And that's the same with corks and such. Over time, that happens. So you get additional oxygen that wants to equalize what it is outside into the inside of the bottle, and that oxygen reacts with whatever's in the bottle, and you get further oxidation. So if you can seal it off, you're kind of, you know, eliminating the addition of more oxygen that will go into the bottle, and that's particularly important if you're using bottle caps. And I have a complaint about corks these days. It seems like the price of corks in the shops is no indication of the quality, because I've tried expensive ones and cheap ones, and they all are kind of crappy. The ones I've been using, you know, half of them leak, not around the sides but through the middle of the cork. So I'm still looking for good corks.
I've got a question. Have you used honeycomb with your reed instead of using bulk honey, using honeycomb?
Using honeycomb.
You guys can answer
that. I never
have. I haven't.
No.
Kirk. We just got some bees on my property from a friend, so I might be soon.
Kurt, what are we drinking?
The one I just passed around was one Harold and I were talking about 2-3 months ago and decided to do one. The one that just came out was a blackcurrant, cherry, blackberry, and strawberry. It started at about 11:55, and it was also made right around May 1st or 2nd, so it's still only 7-8 weeks old. It chewed off about 115 gravity points in about 10 days. I let it finish, racked it off the fruit at about 4 weeks, hit it with some super clear, back sweetened it a little bit, and that's what you got.
What was your fermentation temperature?
Let me see, Minnesota, cold basement, about 65 degrees, probably about 3 degrees warmer. I mean, I was punching the cap down a couple times a day because there was about 24 pounds of fruit and 22 pounds of honey, I believe, or vice versa, one of the two. 5 gallons. I used the Narbonne, the Lalvin 71B. It's pretty much all I use. So,
now, what is your optimum, talking about temperature, what is your optimum fermentation temperature, you guys?
I'd say about 75 for... I have a chest freezer, and then I just put a thermostat in it. If it's cold, I have a heating pad. If it's warm, I turn the refrigeration on, which is more the problem in San Diego. And I did back sweeten my meat as well. I forgot to mention that.
Mine, I kind of... I'm more like Charlie on the temperature thing. Relax. As long as it's not 85 degrees, I really don't care. If I can keep it, you know, below 78 and above whatever temperature the yeast won't work at, I'm happy.
Generally, you know, more often than not, I'm making meads in the late summer or early fall. So, generally 75 degrees is maybe 80 at tops, the initial fermentation. And after... I've racked it a couple of times, depending on how many rackings and whether there's fruit in it. I put fruit in the secondary or herbs in the secondaries fermentation. After most of the fermentation is visibly gone, I will rack it and set it in my walk-in cooler at 55 and just let it. That's where it sleeps for a long time. And it might go for a year. And sometimes it just stops. And it clears up, and it's ready to bottle in 6 months. And it all depends on the actual ingredients and that I put into it or haven't put into it or the quality of the honey.
Do you use a yeast all the time or a different yeast? Does that make a difference?
I think it would. I've never done – I used to do side-by-sides, and definitely it did make a difference in the character, totally different meats. If you ever want to do an interesting experiment, you know, split a batch and – five different 5 gallon jugs and use different yeast, and you will have five different meads.
Or even 1 gallon jugs. Yeah. You can do that as well.
Yeah. I've always used the 75 to 80 degrees that Cornell, you know, laid out as an ideal, but that doesn't mean that I pay that much attention. When I'm scheduled to make mead, I make mead, you know, and I don't worry too much about it. But if you were to say what's the ideal, that's it. I use Prise de Mousse, which is a wine yeast, for all of my meads.
Yeah,
always
I use that. I use Prise de Mousse, and I usually add a package of sherry yeast, too, just to maybe thinking that it'll add some complexity. I'm interested, when do you guys add your fruits to your mead?
Primary.
I do pretty standard fruit winemaking procedures, which is right at the beginning. I know there may be a little bit of a loss of aromatics by taking it through the fermentation process, but there's some other advantages. If I'm working with, say, a mead that I did a couple of years ago, which was a raspberry mead, well, I was working with several packages of frozen raspberries from Trader Joe's, and I wrapped them up in a nylon bag and added them about halfway through cool down. And I do about a 5 minute boil and skim off the albuminous stuff that rises to the top. I know that some of the commercial literature says you're not supposed to do that, ideally, but I've always found it to work. And it's, when you've been successful, it's kind of hard to change, you know, what you're doing. You get kind of trapped that way. But it helps with the cool down very quickly, and if you put it in at about 140 or so, you're not going to lose much in the way of aromatics. I leave the bag. In fact, a lot of times with my meads, if I'm doing a mellow, I'll leave the thing right in my 10-gallon kettle and ferment in there. And I have the things in a bag, so they're nice and easy to handle. Like you would if you were making wine, you punch down the fruit into the liquid, immerse it into the liquid twice a day, or even more often if you wish. And then I haul it out and discard the fruit pulp after about 6 days.
You know, that's interesting. I've listened to brewers who are pretty sophisticated brewers and very knowledgeable, and their use of herbs and fruits in their beers in one manner or fashion. And I've learned from listening to them that it really, really makes a difference at what time you add herbs or spices in your beer and when you add your fruits, because you're going to get different characters. Not that maybe one is better than the other, but it can really affect your end results, because yeast is a living organism. It releases, we all know the fermentation stuff that it does, but it also releases enzymes and other things that digest the chemical compounds that are the flavor of those seeds or those herbs or those spices or probably the fruit. So if there's during the fermentation stage, primary fermentation stage, you're gonna have more of that change of the fruits and herbs and spice character. Change for good or change, let's just say it's different, and then you're going to end up with something different. Generally speaking, I personally have just knowing that, I figure, well, I want to preserve the original character that I know about the herbs and spices, and perhaps I'm interested in just knowing what that combination is without it being broken down during fermentation. So I usually add those fruits and spices after the fermentation, the primary fermentation has quieted down, and I've racked it, and sometimes I get a reinvigoration of the fermentation, and it happens anyway. But generally, I am going for more of the natural essence of whatever those spices are or whatever that fruit is, not because I prefer one over the other, but because I'm prejudiced. That's all.
I will typically let a mead go for maybe 6 or 9 months and then sample it. And if it is a wonderful traditional mead, I'll let it go as a traditional mead. If it's maybe a little below my expectations, that's typically when I will spice and fruit the mead. I've even added fruits a year out, year and a half out. So I tend not to add fruits right at the during fermentation.
Kurt?
Yeah, I pretty much all my fruit additions are in the right as I mix up the must and right before I pitch the yeast. I used to do it after fermentation was complete. I find it gets more integrated into the beverage if it's in the primary. It does kind of change the character of the fruit a little bit, and in a way to combat that is just to take, say you're going to add 15 pounds, put 10 pounds in the primary and save 5 for the secondary, and you'll get some more of that fresher fruit character in the beverage after that.
Now, Byron, you broached the subject.
Yes.
You pasteurize.
What's that?
You said you bring the honey up to the mustard to boil? Or?
I bring it up to a boil for a couple of reasons. One is to, essentially affect a pasteurization. The other is to get it up and skim off some of the solids that actually, the protein material, albumins that will rise to the top, and you can skim them off in just a couple of minutes, 2 to 5 minute boil. And then if you got a chiller, you can get it cooled down right away. Obviously, this is more of a problem if you are commercial and have a more large-scale operation. And at Cornell and other places, they've been doing, very, very fine filtration. And I've heard mixed things about that, both good and bad, that it strips things out that you would like to have left in, as well as some of the things that you'd like to remove. So I'm not sure about that procedure, and we don't really need to do it because the boiling and cooling is not going to damage the honey, in my experience.
It's a different one.
Anyway, that's the way I do it. There's one. Maybe we should also go on and talk about herbs a little bit, because
sure.
what I do mostly for herbs and spices is a lot of times making a tea. I have two techniques that are the main ones. One is making a tea, you know, boiling it up and cooling it down and then adding it to taste at bottling time. And the other is to take whatever it is that I'm trying to extract and making an extract with a small amount of vodka by steeping it for several days and then pouring off. And with different herbs and spices, you know, one of those techniques will, and usually both of them, will work very, very well. You may have a preference for one of those techniques with one of the things and with one type of herb or spice and the other with some, as I do. But the one thing that I'm a little bit leery of is adding it to the heated product, like with beers. I've talked to a lot of home brewers over the years and found that spices are very, very difficult to control by adding to the end of the boil. It's very easy to overdo it. And so I guess I'm chicken. I'm playing it really cautious and making extracts and adding them in later on for balance.
Anybody differ on the spice question?
I tend to add spices at right at the end of the boil and add half what I think I need. And then when I rack and take a gravity reading, oftentimes I find I have to add a little bit more. But as Byron says, if you overdo it, then you have to brew another batch of mead to dilute the overspiced mead that you... So
one of the most fascinating experiences I've had with mead is something I taste and then something I subsequently brewed with, and that's tasting some 50-year-old mead that was made in the 40s. And it was a metheglin, and I tasted it, and I could just detect 60 years later in this sweet, very subtly sherrified mead, really complex honey alcohol flavors, but you could pick out basil and cinnamon and nutmeg, but they were all woven together, and they also combined to make these herbal characters that were nothing, that had the effect of no individual one. And I published this recipe in my Microbrewed Adventures and also in Zymergy, the same thing. And it's a long list of about 14 different herbs and spices, of which all of them combined, it smells like something totally different. And it's just been it's just really fascinating to me. The herbal character is intense, but that mead after... maybe it was a 1 year before I bottled it, and then a subsequent another year. All those spice characters and herbal characters have really begun to come together, and it's those kinds of things. If you do it right and you put it away for many years, you're really in for a treat down the line. That's one of the funnest things, is kind of discovering those you know, how meads can change, and it's really part of the really discovery process. And maybe you can't duplicate it again, but some things, if you pay attention and listen and watch, you can get there.
50 years before you find out.
What was Brother Adam's mead like? Brother Adam, I had the good fortune I went to Buckfast Abbey, I think it was in 1995, and it was about 2 years before his death. And he was 98 at the time. And his mead was pretty simple, straightforward mead, and his, you know, all his recipes and research were in this little shoebox. You know, it was just hands, you know, chicken scratch on 3x5 index cards and a few notes here and there. It was generally straightforward, simple drinking mead that was not necessarily really meant to be or was saved. I had a few bottles. It was on the sweet side and complex, but not terribly so, because given with all that honey, they're probably drinking mead pretty regularly there. They were probably drinking mead pretty regularly.
Honey was a multi-floral honey, though, right? There's pretty much just, the bees are just pretty much on one thing there.
I don't know. It's the landscape in that area. Was it lots of trees and lots of fields? And so they probably had a lot of variety of things that they could get their honey from.
So back to the pasteurization question. Does everybody pasteurize at the table?
I used to bring it to a boil. Now I just bring it just below, just before it starts boiling. But I still get the skim. So, in Colorado, water boil, you know, it'll boil around 100, 195 degrees Fahrenheit, thereabouts, maybe 190. So, you know, about when it gets to about 190, I'll stop, just thinking that I might help preserve a little bit more of that floral honey character rather than try to actually volatilize it.
I typically take about 3 or 3.5 gallons of water and maybe warm it up to 120 degrees or so, just so that when I pour my honey and I stir it, it just dissolves quicker. But I'm basically a no-boil guy. I used to boil all my meads.
What do you do with your – do you use crystallized honey? I mean, is your honey crystallized? Yeah.
Sometimes. Just when you mix honey with room temperature water, it sometimes takes takes a while for it.
That's another reason why I need it, to dissolve it.
It just dissolves a lot quicker. Yeah, and the mixer, yeah, that's true. The mixer makes it a lot easier on the end of a drill. But basically, I don't boil. I used to, but.
One reason I do that, or get the temperature up at least fairly high, is to add my dry ingredients under what are basically sanitary conditions. The only things that I don't add under the hot temperatures are yeast, of course, and peptic enzyme. Yeah.
So honey is the heart and soul of the mead, obviously. What are your favorite honeys, and what are honeys that you find, or did you find any honeys that didn't work?
Yeah, plenty of them. When I first on the whole heat thing, I don't do any heat whatsoever. I do just everything's room temperature. If the honey's crystallized, I put it in some warm water until it gets liquid, and everything's no heat at all. So, but as far as nasty honey,
can you also say something about this mead that we're drinking right now?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah, quickly. It's a red currant, black currant. It was made on the same day as the other one. It's got a little darker honey. It was the killer bee, sold as killer bee honey from the bee folks. But it was just a darker, more flavorful honey, and yeah, it's got a more honey character in this one than the other one. Bad honeys. I think the worst one I think I've ever used is straight dandelion blossom. It got warm enough one spring, and the bees were active, and the only thing that was out were dandelions, and they recovered the honey right before their early season stuff, and the honey was actually very nice and flavorful. The resulting mead was a little less so.
And your favorite?
Probably the wildflower I get from a supplier in Wisconsin. Probably one of my other favorite would be Tupelo.
You ever blend several honeys?
Sometimes I'll blend two honeys, but yeah, I've never done several.
I've used just generally use field honey if that's available around our area, and that probably is alfalfa or clover. But I've had great results with orange blossom and mesquite honey, and I don't know how many of you know John Carlson. He's a mead maker from Colorado, and he's a mead enthusiast. He usually has lots of different meads, and I've had some of his stuff, and I've had some really great buckwheat honey mead, and I've had some really great raspberry mead, raspberry honey mead. Some of his stuff is just so wonderfully complex, and it's beyond what I do. So that's part of just kind of listening. And
I think in Southern California, we largely get citrus honey, so you have to go seek out other sources. I think probably the neatest honey I've worked with lately is buckwheat honey, but for those of you in the Midwest, apparently your buckwheat honey is very different than what we get, and that I guess you can't use very much buckwheat honey in a mead. And I brew meads with 100% buckwheat honey in that we get in California. It's much less intense than what. So you have to know, I think, obviously where the honey is coming from and how intense. Because I've read on Tech Talk that some people can't use more than 20% buckwheat honey in their meads, and I thought that was a rather peculiar comment, but I guess in the Midwest they are really intensely flavored.
Well, one of the things that got me started making mead years ago was a local fruit stand, and I'm not sure why they had it, but they had an absolutely gorgeous, truly exceptional clover honey from way up north. Of course, we can't get it in our area. I have to get it and bring it in. But clover honey is really my favorite honey to work with, although I'll have to say that in judging meads, you know, here and there, I've had some exceptional meads with orange blossom and mesquite and a few others. And if you were to ask about unsatisfactory ones, being from California, I'd probably have to say eucalyptus.
I'll second that, too. I've used that one once.
You mentioned something about judging. You know, some of the best meads I've had have had very low scores in competitions. So don't be discouraged if you make what you think is a really, really good mead and you get it to competition and it's so unusual. Or it's generally usually a complex or a quality that I imagine judges aren't familiar with. And therefore, they're not comfortable. So, you know, the stuff that's more, the flavors that are more identifiable, I'm guessing maybe get higher scores, but I've had some great meads that said, I'm not going to send my mead anymore to the competition. This has got only a 20, you know? And I was going, how? I mean, it's fantastic. You know, it's just not, doesn't fit into the realm of what's known. And so I encourage you to just, you know, not necessarily to try to copy and do what we say or copy something you've read about, but go off on your own, experiment, and you'll discover some really cool stuff.
We've got about 5 minutes left, so who's got questions? You're the closest.
Any techniques for sparkling mead, bottle-conditioned sparkling? How do you approach that?
I carbonate in a keg. I've given up trying to sparkle a mead bottle conditioning. I just carbonate in a keg and either counter-pressure fill or beer gun, cap and wax, and put it away.
Especially if it's a sweeter mead. If you can't, it's, yeah. You just don't know when it's going to stop. So.
Could you start a sorbet to fill the yeast so it does not continue?
You got a good chance of it not continuing to ferment, but not 100%.
So on that note, do you, any of you ever intentionally crash your meads, either by chilling or chemically, or do you just let them naturally ferment out to wherever they want to go?
I do if I decide that I want to leave something still. Now, this is not during the height of that first month or so of fermentation. But later on during the winter, things will really, really, really slow down. And you'll often see a little bit of yeast activity, even in the colder weather, you know, occasionally little bubbles rising. And if it's where I want it, and I don't want it to go any further, I will add potassium sorbate or Sorbistat K to it, and it will work almost always. Like Kurt says, it's not 100%, but it's the only product for that the wine industry has. And it's harder to you have to do something to stop mead from fermenting. If it's got the sugar in there, you know, it's going to keep going in the bottle. So in terms of sparkling mead, I don't do anything. I just cap it.
What's the highest gravity that you'll go to before you'll bottle?
I'd be kind of nervous if it was too much beyond about 6 bricks, which is about 24, 25 specific gravity.
Yeah,
how you decide if you're going to do it and how much you add and how you go about doing that?
Taste it. Decide whether it needs it or not. Take a sample. You know, add a little sugar syrup, you know, and see if it improves it or if it makes it worse.
Yeah, you know, what I've done is I actually take a sample. If I know I'm going to sweeten it, I'll take a sample out, put it in a flask, and I'll bring that sample up to something past where I want it. And then I'll take some more of the stock mead and blend it into 4 samples that are 10 gravity points apart. And then I can taste all of those. And you need help doing that because your palate gets crushed in about 30 seconds. So, and then start mixing the two together. You'll help. And then you can get all the splits in between if it's not quite, and then just calculate how much honey you need to bring your other volume up to what that gravity is.
Generally, what I do with if I get have a mead that's too dry is I just generally just keep it in the carboy and brew a very sweet mead, and you know, really high gravity, higher gravity, and then blend it, and then watch it to make sure it doesn't start fermenting again, and just. Of course, I have the stash to have that kind of patience. But to answer that other question, I consider myself lucky. I've put mead in bottles corked at 1053, but I've let it sit in the carboy for a whole year, and there's absolutely no visible signs. Of course, that's no guarantee that it could start up again. But
yeah, when I bottle meads, I make sure they're really mature, really old. They sat in a keg for about a year before I try to bottle them so I don't have any bombs in the blow-up. And then back sweetening, I take more of a Papazian approach. I just sort of warm up a little honey on the stove so it pours easily into the carboy, and then I take my racking cane and kind of stir it up, and then I use it as a thief and take a little taste and don't worry too much about it. And then I'm not nearly as scientific about it as Kurt is.
By the way, I brought some mead today, too, but we didn't get here in time to get it cooled down, so it'll be at the Sonoma Bureaucrats booth at the club night tonight. You can taste one of my experiments.
By the way, I opened up one of your award-winning lime mint, was it?
Oh, yeah.
Just about 3 weeks ago at an event. It was really good.
Yeah. Thank you.
You actually did the lime mead where you won the mead maker of the year.
Right.
Yeah.
The purest mead I'd ever seen.
Thank you.
Can you talk about that honey because it was like water?
Well, it was clover honey, but I got a good share of the acidity by fresh squeezing lime juice into the mead and adding it. I did add that after cool down, I took it up to, 0.65%, that was it. The other thing that we did, you could do it with zest. I happen to have lime oil, and I think we used about 3 cc's in a 5.5 gallon batch or something like that. We used about 3 cc's of Boyajian lime oil mixed it in as best we could, after fermentation for the aromatics of it.
I have a question I want to ask everybody. I tasted a mead, a Bochet mead, a Bochet, B-O-C-H-E-T. I didn't know what it was at the time until I went on Google and Googled it. And the only thing I could find out is Bochet, that's a burnt mead. All I can figure is that it's some kind of honey. It's honey that's been heat caramelized and then fermented. I don't think it's anything else. Because the mead was one of those 60-year-old meads I had. It was very dark. There was absolutely no tannin that was thrown, so there was no fruit, no herbs, no anything that was added after that long of time. You usually have some kind of sediment thrown. This was absolutely crystal clear. Has anybody ever made Bochet, if that's the correct way to pronounce it? It was fantastic. It was really fantastic. It was very sherry-like, caramelly, toffee, without being intense. It was very, very something to play around and then share your experiences with.
Well,
with
us all. I'm getting the time signal from the door. Blame her. So thank you everyone for sharing your expertise.
What a great panel. I appreciate the opportunity to be a part of it. And next week we'll hear the other panel that I moderated, the Beer Troubleshooting Panel with Ken Grossman, Vinny Chalurzo, Tommy Arthur, John Palmer, and Michael Ferguson. Not bad. It was a lot of good information and some fun as well. So be sure to tune in next week. Remember, we've got the Brewer's Logbook and our new Basic Winemaking Introduction to Wine Kits DVD out there on our online store. If you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to james@basicbrewing.com or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com, and please don't forget to tell us where you're from. You can also check out our other DVDs, Low-Tech Lagering and Decoction Mashing, Stepping into All Grain, and Introduction to Extract Home Brewing. We've got combo deals on our site to save you a few bucks, and you can see a listing of the fine folks across the country who sell our DVDs on basicbrewing.com. And if there isn't a vendor in your area, you can order it online in our online shop at basicbrewingshop.com. We've got shirts available as well. And thanks to everybody who's continued to click on our Amazon.com link. We appreciate the support there. Our featured products this week that were purchased through the links are Toshiba Satellite A355S6924 16-inch laptop and Unicorn Magnum Plus Peppermill 9-inch. Thanks again, everybody. Remember, I can't tell who bought what, so no worries there. Just click on the Amazon.com logo on our site. The next time you feel like Amazon shopping, we appreciate your support. Also, we have those links to the American Homebrewers Association affiliate program and Brew Your Own, of course, as usual. Thanks, everybody. That's all until next week. Until then, thanks for listening. I'm James Spencer. Production help for Basic Brewing Radio and our website is provided by our buddy Kelly Dodson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next week. So long.